This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined again by Bradley Chambers. We have three sponsors for the show tonight. The first is Squarespace. Start building your website today at squarespace.com. Enter the offer code PUPIL at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace, build it beautiful. The show is also brought to you by Shobi, an iPad app for paperless classrooms. Shobi makes it easy to assign, collect, and review student work and provide rich feedback with annotations, voice notes, grades, and more. And finally, Jam Software, provide IT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies, such as Macs, iPads, iPhone, and Apple TV in education. More about them at jamsoftware.com, and I'll tell you more about all of those as the show goes on. Bradley, come in.
I am here.
How are you doing?
I'm good. It's no baby yet, because we are recording a bit early just to have one in the pipe. I'm sure by the time this show comes out, which will be... we will have a baby. The plan is, if she doesn't have the baby by Thursday, then they're going to induce. So, yeah, we will have it soon.
Okay. It's definitely coming. It's one of those things that's just rolling towards you. It's going to come one day. So,
yes, we are prepared. But the most important thing is getting my new iPhone 6S Plus. Mm-hmm. And we have made the switch to T-Mobile.
Oh, so that happened.
Yes. Now, you know, obviously, if you're outside the U.S., you care nothing about this. But, like, folks in the U.S., I've actually gotten a ton of Twitter questions, and I've asked a ton, like, when I was thinking about switching. And we switched our corporate account. So thing about T-Mobile is this different is, like, there are no contracts. So you're either going to be buying the phone outright, or you can sign up for their, like, jump-on-demand programs, which is basically their leasing plans. And say what you want about T-Mobile's coverage. Their policies are forcing everybody else to kind of be more aggressive. You know, they announced a brand new iPhone upgrade deal, and then everybody else kind of had to follow. So it's working well so far. The thing I like about the service so far is two things. It has nothing to do with cellular coverage, is what's funny. Number one is they support Wi-Fi calling in the U.S., mm-hmm. and AT&T is working on that. They don't have it in my area, but they're slowly rolling it out. And then Verizon has none of it, and Sprint has it as well. So basically, we get terrible cell phone service inside of our building, and we had microcells for AT&T, and they worked okay. Of course, like many schools are going to have concrete blocks, and so cellular signals is a challenge. Mm-hmm. Well, the cool thing about T-Mobile is you can turn on, like in your iPhone, you can turn on Wi-Fi calling, it connects, and it uses your Wi-Fi connection for phone calls, and so works very well. It also supports continuity in iOS 9. So, like, even if I leave my iPhone at home, I can actually still receive calls on my Mac.
Oh, okay.
Even without, you know. And then the other thing is, like, totally, you know, just personal related. They have a thing called Music Freedom, where streaming music services don't count against your quota. So I have 10 gigs of high speed data per month. There are no overages. It just slows you down after 10 gigs. Mm-hmm. And like Apple Music and Spotify and RDO and Google Play Music and all of the above, they are exempt from that. So, yeah, working well so far. Coverage is fine here in Chattanooga on LTE most places. A few places I went to 4G, but AT&T was the same way, to be honest. It wasn't LTE everywhere. And they bought out our contracts, and kind of pretty happy with it so far.
There you go. How are you liking the iPhone 6S?
I like it. The 3D Touch, like, it's one of those things where the apps that have it, like, it's really nice. And then, like, it just makes you very frustrated, the apps that don't have it. Mm. Slack is one that totally needs to adopt it. And then there's just, again, when over the next few months, I'm sure all my core apps will support it and be great. The camera is fantastic. Restoring was difficult this time. I normally like to restore from iTunes, mm-hmm. but I couldn't get it to transfer my purchased apps back to my Mac. And I imagine it's because I'm on, like, the iOS 9.1 beta. So I had to do an iCloud restore, which meant I had to go through the song and dance of setting up the phone, putting it on the public beta, updating it, wiping it, and then restoring from iCloud. The thing I hate about restoring from iCloud is you have to enter so many passwords, where when you restore from iTunes, you don't. I don't even know the technical reason for that, but, like, it's annoying. And I feel like iCloud's restoring, like, it works fine. It's simple. But then, like, the user experience of getting your phone back to where, like, you're ready to use it is very difficult.
Yeah, and there's one or two classic apps that, you know, don't really survive that kind of process. And the one that always gets me is the Amazon Kindle app, which never restores properly ever for some reason. And also, whenever you re-register it with Amazon, you get another entry in your device list on the Kindle website. And I had a reason to have a call with Amazon at one point about tech support for the Kindle, and the guy said, "How many Kindles do you actually have?" And I was like, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, there's something like 65 different devices registered to your account." And I was like, "Well, what are you talking about?" And we eventually realized that this was like all the times that I had either uninstalled and reinstalled the app, or restored a phone, or restored an iPad, because obviously we're doing this quite a lot, you know, you and I. And every time that becomes another device that has somehow at one time contacted your Amazon account. So it's, Amazon's always weird about that. So that's something that's been annoying me quite a lot recently.
Well, and I don't even know the technical reason, like some apps can do it. I don't know if something the apps have to like build in, or something like Apple could even do on the iOS side. But you can imagine, like, if you've got, a student that's got like a ton of apps on their iPad that are like kind of hooked into cloud services, if they have like a damaged iPad they have to swap out, I mean, we talked about, you know, mean time to repair during the deployment series.
Yeah.
Like, it's one thing to get them a new device. It's another thing to have it where it's like, it's got your stuff and it's ready to go. Now, I know students don't have all the apps that we do, but it's very frustrating. And I mean, thankfully, like, the first thing you obviously I do is like download Dropbox, then 1Password, because then it hooks into my Dropbox. And then you kind of go to town, and apps that support like Dropbox or 1Password, that's fantastic. But then like some of them don't, and it's very frustrating. Mm-hmm. Then you have your apps that support 2-factor, but don't, like, you have to make an application specific password. So yeah, it probably took me an hour and a half to completely set my phone up, like, back to where all the apps were logged in and ready to go.
And you carry a pretty minimal phone as well, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. Like, I call apps all the time, but, like, I mean, again, let's look at my home screen. You got Yahoo Sports, have to log back in. Google Photos, have to log in. Dropbox, have to log in. Wunderlist, had to log back in. Evernote, had to log back in. 1Password, had to log back in. Slack, had to log in 5 times. Instapaper did restore, and it didn't require me to log in. Instagram did not require me to log back in. Tweetbot did. Fitbit did. He Reads Truth did. They don't, like, actually, it worked. It restored. Dark Sky didn't matter. And then Overcast worked because it's hooked into iCloud. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, like, I mean, literally over half of the apps on my home screen, I had to log back into.
Yeah, that's the pain, you know. And I use my phone a lot for things like video as well. So I have like 4 or 5 different video streaming apps that I would sign into. You know, you get, well, the BBC iPlayer doesn't require one, but then you get Amazon and Netflix and Plex, and then ITV Player, because the Rugby World Cup's on right now and it's all on ITV, so I'm using their app more often than not. So yeah, it can get annoying. It can
definitely. But yeah, that's annoying. I mean, again, I'm thinking like from a student's perspective, if they happen to like break their iPad over the weekend and come in Monday, and you got one ready to swap.
Yeah,
that's just like it's. Yeah, it's not as simple as like, hey, all my apps are downloaded. Now it's like I have to log into all of them.
Yeah.
And like we were sitting up, I had an employee that they got a new phone today, and I was swapping them out, and we were porting their number. And like, I've yet to figure out like when everything's done, and then like iCloud is still saying it's about like restoring from backup, because I was trying to like do a software update to 9.0.1, mm-hmm. and it said you have to wait until this backup is finished restoring. I'm like, what's it not restoring? Like, everything's done.
Yeah, the one thing that can, depending on what kind of level of advancement you are with the photo stuff, is if you're restoring the camera roll, that can restore in the background for a very long time. If you're not using iCloud Photo Library, and that's one of the nice things about iCloud Photo Library, it doesn't hold you up in that situation. I've been very happy with that, actually. That's probably one of the best things Apple shipped in a long time, Photo Library.
So before we move on, let's thank our first sponsor of the night, fine folks at Squarespace. Happy to welcome them back to the show. Mike Chambers Deli is hosted on Squarespace. Fraser's blog is hosted there. I probably have 10 freelance websites I do, all hosted on Squarespace. Incredibly easy. The sites look professionally designed. And you can do this regardless of your skill level. You don't have to code anything. State-of-the-art technology, no security updates to apply. It just works. Millions and millions of people have it, and it starts at just $8 a month. And if you sign up for a year, you get a free domain name with it. So that's worth like $10. Again, easy to use, drag and drop. All templates are responsive. If you're looking to build a website for your school, for your project, for your baseball team, soccer team, football team, club, absolutely check out Squarespace. You have a free trial, no credit card required, 14-day free trial. Go to squarespace.com and sign up for a trial. And when you purchase it, because we know you will, use the offer code PUPIL, P-U-P-I-L, and get 10% off your first purchase. So that knocks, if you do that and pay for it by the year, you get a pretty good discount on the yearly plan. So again, that's squarespace.com. Use the offer code PUPIL for 10% off. Thanks to Squarespace for sponsoring the show this week. Squarespace, build it beautiful.
Okay, good stuff. So a little bit of news follow-up, Bradley. Today it was announced, or recently it was announced, that Apple are going to pay Los Angeles Unified School District $4.2 million for the failed iPad deployment. And boy, I wish I could get paid that kind of money for things that I screw up as well.
Yeah, and I'm sure there's like more to the story in terms of like, you know, Apple's role. But the money is so, like, so minimal. Like, you wonder if it's just like Apple, that's Apple basically paying it to make the story go away.
Yeah. When I read through some of it, it seems to me that what has probably happened is that Apple were doing the deal and they were taking the because the whole thing kind of revolves around two things. One is the security problems they had with their device profiles, which may or may not be on Apple's head. But then there was a big problem with the Pearson curriculum that was supposed to be delivered with the devices, which, either, depending on what report you read, either wasn't ready or was ready and sucked, or just something in between. It was incomplete. It only had sample lessons or whatever. And it seems that, as far as I can sort of see, that the amount of money that Apple's paying back is basically the money that would have been paid to license the Pearson curriculum for each device. So it's you know, maybe it is Pearson's fault at the end of the day, but of course, because it's Apple and that makes the headlines, Apple's going to get the blame. I mean, I don't know, maybe Apple does deserve a lot of the blame for it, but in general, it just seems to have been a whole mess. And, you know, the FBI are involved now in different things like that. So,
well, yeah, because Apple's obviously not getting the iPads back, and they've obviously been used. And so there's no reason for them to have to pay that money. And, it, you know, I'm just like speculating. Maybe there was like somebody at Apple promised something that Apple couldn't deliver. I don't know. I'm just like thinking outside the box on why Apple would be at any fault here. And again, I'm not one to think that Apple has no faults, because they certainly do. But this, to me, is just such a small, I mean, they've made this while we've been talking on the show from probably like accessory sales.
yeah.
And so for them, the worst thing they can do is continue to have negative press around iPad deployments. Mm-hmm. And so it's just like, make it go away. And this is a make it go away kind of payment.
Yeah, this is sort of a, you know, no fault, underline, end of story kind of thing. So we shall await with interest the results of the FBI investigation as well. Other thing, Bradley, I was going to just mention really quickly is that there's a new Android tablet out, which is called the Pixel C, which is, I don't know if you caught this news yet, it's just out in the past couple of hours, but this is essentially it's like the Android version of the iPad Pro, as far as I can see. But it's quite interesting they've called it the Pixel C rather than some Nexus brand name. And also it's a device called Pixel that doesn't run Chrome OS, which is kind of weird too.
You know, Chris, I had not seen this before we started the show. It's been, you and I were talking before the show. I'm like trying to prepare for a vacation with having this baby. And so I missed the news, but I like feel like in education, Google would do well to ignore Android, because I don't think, like, I think they've got some schools running, you know, I know they've got some schools running Android, but their best bet with schools is to go, is not necessarily, I don't think like when you're going to compare, like, you're not going to go into an iPad school and sell them Android. I just don't think it's going to work.
No.
I also don't think you're going into a Mac school and selling Android. Because if the Mac school is going to change from a Mac, they're probably changing to the iPad. I also don't think you're going into a PC school and selling Android. I do think you're going into a PC school and selling Chromebooks. I do think you're going into a Mac school and selling Chromebooks. I think you could possibly go into an iPad school where it wasn't deployed properly and the teachers weren't trained properly and sell Chromebooks. And so I feel like the Chrome OS line is their bread and butter in education.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly know of schools where they are using Android tablets. I mean, it's not like it doesn't exist. But I do think that some of the – it's kind of weird, I think, how some of the schools who are running Android tablets suddenly got multi-platform religion as soon as it looked like Apple was going to be the dominant platform. You know, these are schools that just ran complete Windows hegemony for years and years and years, and then suddenly as soon as iPad comes in, oh, it's really important to have a mix of platforms in the school. Like, yeah, come on, you're not really being intellectually honest there, I don't think. But there are certainly schools who, you know, I know schools, you know, we had Tim Lauer on the show. He has a mix of Chromebooks and Android tablets in his school. So it's not like it doesn't exist, but I think what I see is like Android tablets are a lot easier to share than iPads are, really. And I think what you see is, you know, we're getting a set of tablets, and some schools, you know, I suspect perhaps correctly, might make the decision that if we're just going to sort of sprinkle some magic tablet dust on the school, let's make it easy for ourselves and go the Android route. But, you know, as I've always said, and I think you would agree with me, Bradley, that going one-to-one is the real transformational step, and it's not necessarily the device as much as going one-to-one is the most important part of that.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't mean to insinuate that, like, no one has Android in their school. I mean, like, on a whole, like, if you polled, you know, 50,000 schools, like, what percent of that is Android? It's going to be, you know, it's going to be the smallest. And so I just feel like for Google, I almost feel like it would be like Apple pitching the iPod Touch to schools.
Or even the Mac, for that matter.
Yeah, I mean, because it's all about iPad for schools now. I mean, I know schools do deploy Macs, but like it is the focus is iPad. The Chrome OS, like I had some guys from, you know, we're in Chattanooga in Cleveland, Tennessee, is about 30 minutes north of us. So some of their IT folks came down and we were talking Wi-Fi strategy and Wi-Fi security and things like that today. And we were talking about like Chrome OS versus like Windows versus like Mac. And first thing they said was like, you know, Chrome OS, what is amazing about that is how great Google Drive works and like the ease of management.
Yeah.
And so I feel like it's like they should almost like play up that and go with their focus should be, let's go into these like schools that are serving PCs and let's pitch Chromebooks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I've always thought that Chrome OS is a much bigger threat to, you know, Dell and Windows than it is to iPad deployments. You know, if the schools who are going Chromebook were really looking for something really new and different, they would already be iPad schools. You know, and they're not looking for something very different to what they've got. But, you know, Chromebooks are basically, in large part, they're cheaper typing. You know, they're more secure, yes, easier to deploy, yes, more performant, more sustainable. There's lots of advantages for Chrome OS over Windows, but having been through this entire conversation at our school, we could not see substantial student advantages for Chromebook over iPad in the round of all the things we do in school.
And I think it depends on like where your school's at,
mm-hmm.
and what your goals, and obviously it goes back to what your goals are, what you're going to be doing, and your budget. I mean, because mm-hmm. a Chrome OS deployment is cheaper than an iPad deployment done right. Like I'm not, you know, I think if you're going to go one-to-one, full size iPad, or I guess, I'm sorry, let me correct that, mid-size iPad. it's going to get weird. Mid-size iPad, minimum 32 gigs, if not 60. You know, if you're buying the iPad Air 2, it's going to be 64. So a Chrome OS deployment is certainly cheaper, and I would much rather see a school go one-to-one Chromebook
mm-hmm.
than go, you know,
shared iPad.
Like a shared iPad deployment. I mean, again, it's just going, and it all comes down to like what you're trying to do and your staffing. And I think it's a great conversation to have. And I think for most schools, most of the conversation today is around iPad versus Chrome OS.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, but when you look at that complete discussion from a sysadmin standpoint, from a teacher standpoint, from a student standpoint, by gosh, that's a great world to live in when those are your two options.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we're both on record now, Bradley, saying that both of them are good options. I personally think that a school who has gone one-to-one iPad is a hard, very hard sell for that kind of school to go one-to-one Chromebook later on. And in the same way that a school that's like one-to-one MacBook Pro, right, it's a hard sell to get them to go one-to-one iPad. You know, I've talked to schools in that situation, and there are not many of those kind of schools in the world, but those that are, or that have a strong laptop culture, it's a very hard sell to get them to go iPad. And then, you know, a lot of this is about where you start your journey. And, you know, you could see in a day to come, possibly the iPad becomes a step forward from a one-to-one Chromebook deployment, but possibly not. You know, and I don't think there's nothing wrong with Chromebook. I just think that overall, the tablet form factor plus iOS and the apps that are available give you a much broader palette of things you could do in the school. And I've said many times before, Bradley, that I think there's possibly the most toxic idea in educational technology is the idea that there's only two things you do with a computer in school. One is you use an office suite, and the other is you program them. And if you think that that's the only two things you would do with a computer in school, you are fundamentally wrong. And I think that's it's actually that mindset that is the battle, rather than even a platform war. It's, you know, it's not just about those two things. It's about much, much more than that. And I think that's where, personally, I feel the iPad gives the most kind of broad sweep of things that you can do with a computer. You can do many, many more things with an iPad than you can with a Chromebook, practically speaking. And that's where I guess we are right now in our thoughts.
So before we move on for the main topic for tonight, let's thank our second sponsor, the fine folks at Jamf Software. You guys know Jamf. They provide IT staff with great tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies in schools, Macs, iPhones, iPads, and even Apple TVs. They have a great app for teachers called Casper Focus that allows them to take control of their classroom. They can quickly gain a student's attention. They can conduct secure exams with inside of an app. They can select a specific Apple TV. They can choose and distribute iBooks and initiate AirPlay right from within Casper Focus. Learn what else you can do with Casper Focus and the Casper Suite at jampsoftware.com. That's jamfsoftware.com. Fraser and I both have webinars coming up in October with Jamf, so be on the lookout for some information about that very soon.
Okay, yeah. So, Bradley, we're going to try and hit two chapters tonight, mainly because chapter 8, I think, is quite short in terms of what it has that's relevant for us. And then we're going to look at chapter 9. So chapter 8 is about diffusion networks, and chapter 9 is about the role of the change agent as a particular individual in the process of diffusion. And I think we'll try and hit both of those tonight, if that works for you.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, as I, you know, been reading the book and like thinking about it and reading our notes, like, so many of the terms like I've heard, like, in just in business life in general, like, they're from this book. I mean, yeah. I've heard the term change, like, you know, you've got to be a change agent so many times in my life. Like, that's from this book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, suddenly you realize where all this comes together in one kind of almost grand unifying theory. It's not, I wouldn't say it was quite that, but it's this guy, Everett Rogers, is the originator of many of these terms, and or at least the popularizer of many of these terms, from this very influential book that we're reading, which, if you're new to the series, we're looking at the book Diffusion of Innovations by Everett Rogers, which is we've been looking at for the past three or four shows, and this is another one in that series. So, diffusion networks, Bradley, what do you think?
Well, I mean, it's one of those, like, you know, chapter 8's like, to me, it's like you just kind of laid down the foundation, and chapter 8 feels like it's the place where you kind of, like, take a little bit of a step forward. So diffusion networks are, like, it's the process by how ideas and innovations are spread among your social system. And again, like, these social systems don't have to mean your neighborhood or your school. They can be, like, kind of like anything.
Yeah, even up to the scale of, you know, a whole country or whatever. In the chapter, I think that there's a little bit, there's a fair bit actually about questions around about at what stage is the mass media more appropriate as a way to diffuse your innovation and ideas versus interpersonal networks. And I think, you know, for the school context, I'm not sure that that's a particularly interesting or useful thing to discuss for us, because you know, there's no school who are going to, you know, make a TV advert or take out a billboard to promote their one-to-one program, really. There might be one or two, but I think you got to scale it down quite a lot. And are we talking about putting up a poster in the lunch hall, or are we talking about getting staff together and talking to them and so on? And I think what you find is that both have a role, but at different stages and for different kinds of information and different purposes overall, that you would use these different kinds of information flow. So that's a big part of it. You got to think about where does your strategy come from and how do you communicate with people? And I suppose from school to school, Bradley, it's going to vary very much as to how much of that kind of mass communication you have to do versus being able to sit down individuals or groups and talk to them directly.
Well, it's like if you're trying to think of an example. Let's say, for example, like you're doing an email migration and you're moving from like Office to Google Apps. What do you think is going to be more effective? Like putting up posters with like Eric Schmidt on it that says, we want you in our Google Apps domain, like in the old Uncle Sam. You know, it's like, you know, what's probably going to be more helpful is for you to go to individual staff members and say like, hey, here's some of the things we can do with this new system. We're really excited about it. Like, if you have any questions before we transition? And it's like kind of looking at, I kind of put it in terms of like, what's more effective to you to learning, to deciding to buy a product, seeing a billboard or like hearing it from a friend who has it, like word of mouth type thing. Mm-hmm. And I think in most situations, like they kind of work in hand in hand. So like you might see a billboard for a product and then like when someone like, you know, influenced you to see it, like, and you can see it in action, like that's, it's like taking it a step further. And so from like, you know, implementing technology change in your school, it can be all of the above. Like it can, you know, it's not just has, you know, advertising. And this is essentially what we're talking about is like, how do you market things? It's going to be all of the above. And so you can say, look, we're going to have, you know, billboards, you know, coming soon, Google Apps to our school, this date, see so-and-so for more information. But you could still also have like a, hey, can I come by during your, you know, planning period and show you some things we can do on this new system and answer any questions you have. Like all that to me works like hand in hand and reinforces the other.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think the message that I kind of took away from this chapter, Bradley, was not that you would never do a poster, but also to be aware that a poster campaign alone will not be enough to really embed the change that you're going to do. And it has to be, you know, probably a phased approach, right? The first thing is you've got to raise awareness. And then, you know, if you go back to the innovation decision process chapter that we talked about, the process is somebody becomes aware of a potential innovation. They then have an imbalance of information and therefore an increase in uncertainty about what that innovation means for them. And then there are steps available in order to reduce that uncertainty. So there's research, there's talking to people, there's looking at reviews, there's, you know, trying it out yourself, and then eventually making a decision about whether or not to adopt. And I think really what we're looking at here is we're looking at that process from the outside rather than from the inside. So when we looked at the innovation decision process, we were looking at the process that the individual sees from the inside, seeing, you know, the external information, I have this uncertainty, I'm taking steps to reduce it, and now I'm able to make a decision. And what the Diffusion Network chapter is really doing, I think, is it's looking at it the other way, and it's saying, okay, here are the stages we need to provide support in so that people, as they go through this process, will still find us to be useful and helpful at each stage along the process. Does that seem like a reasonable way to cut it?
Yeah. No, it's. I think if you take anything away from this chapter is, like, how things are spread is a puzzle, and if you're missing a piece, like it may not spread as quickly. And so, like your message is a puzzle, and so your message will be displayed more clearly. And I think that's the key term for me is clearly, because it's one thing to say. I mean, how many times have we like, you know, I don't know, we do a payroll migration, and people just like, it's not that they care, they just like don't understand. Well, oftentimes it's not being communicated clearly what the change is. And so, like, you know, when you state your you know, your plan clearly or what you're doing clearly, it all fits together like a puzzle, and you just reach people different ways.
Yeah, completely agree. And I think the next thing that Rogers kind of brings in this discussion is he talks again about opinion leadership. And we saw that in the last chapter with those early adopters, those people who are well respected within their community, but are on the not quite the bleeding edge, but certainly the leading edge of the adoption curve. And what the property of opinion leadership really is it's the degree to which an individual can influence others in the social system. And one of the things that I know I haven't put it in the notes for tonight, but I just wanted to mention as well, Bradley, is the idea that a given individual can either be an opinion leader in just one area, or they can be considered an opinion leader in all areas. And what you're looking for, I think, is you're looking for that person who can have a wide range of influence in a lot of different topics. So you might have somebody in school, for example, who is considered an expert, I don't know, in PE, let's say. And anything to do with kind of physical fitness and health and activity, they will be very influential in guiding other people's views on the matter. But then you have other people who are, they're just considered leaders in the school, and their views on curriculum and timetabling and classroom layout and decorating the walls and whatever, you know, whatever they think about a lot of things can be influential to people. And depending on what your particular innovation is, you might want to find just the person who's extremely influential in just that one area, or you might want to find the person who's influential in all areas and get them on your side as well if you possibly can. So there's a couple of different ways that opinion leadership can work as well, depending on what the topic is at hand.
Well, and I think that's the key, what the topic is. I mean, different people are going to be perceived often as like experts on different things, you know, and I think... I think it's just going to like often perception among people groups is like is very, very important. And it goes back to like where in the adopter, like in the what category are you in our from a previous, you know, are you someone that's like, you know, if you're someone that's perceived to be an expert in this area, but yet you're perceived to be an innovator, you may have like less of an influence. Like, it, you know, you kind of want to be in that middle range.
Yeah. Yeah, very definitely. So there's that. And then the author also introduces these two phrases that I had not heard before. I didn't know these phrases, homophily and heterophily, which are the degree to which participants in a social system are alike or different in the case of homophily or heterophily, respectively. And what's quite interesting, though, Bradley, is he says that people tend to communicate with people who are like them in various respects, whether that be education or training or socioeconomic status or outlook on life or whatever. But what he says is that if there's too much of that homophily, that similar groupings of attitudes and ideas, that can actually be a barrier to adoption because people resist input from others who they see as being materially different to them in terms of either their socioeconomic status, their education, their technical expertise. For example. So what you're trying to do as well is you're trying to mix up the groupings, if you like. So whenever you, let's say, just as an example, whenever you have an event to promote your iPad or your Chromebook deployment in school, don't let people sit with their friends, right? do something to mix up the groups a little bit so that you get that degree of difference in attitude across the groupings that people are sitting in. And that's one way that you can increase that degree of heterophily, so that you can get exposure to a range of different attitudes about the innovation as well. Because you might, you know, I don't know if you've seen this, Bradley, when you're speaking to groups, but I've certainly seen it where you maybe come in and there's six or seven tables there, and then you quickly realize that one table is a grumpy table that hates the idea. And that's an example of a sort of homophilous group of people sitting together, having the same attitudes and the same opinions and being very resistant to external stimulus about the innovation at hand.
Yeah, and yeah, you can always pick that out. And like you have the one table that like they're sitting up straight, they get there early, they're smiling, and the other table kind of wanders in towards the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a classic speaker's dilemma, isn't it?
Yes, it's like do I mention that they're late or no?
No, never call people out. So.
No, definitely not.
Yeah, I was at an event yesterday where somebody called someone out for going to the bathroom during their talk. I was like,
"Ooh,
don't do that."
Like, gotta go to the bathroom. I mean, that's, yeah. You know, it's like, I feel like that's one of the biggest, like, mind-blowing things that you realize, like, when you get out of school, that you can just go to the bathroom whenever you want. It's
like, yeah, you need whenever to go, you want, however many times.
Just go. I mean, it's like, because you're in school, it's like, you just went. Like, you don't need to go again. Raise your hand. You know, it's like, yeah. I need to go to the bathroom. I just go. My 5-year-old proceeds to tell me every morning, says, "Daddy, I'm going to the bathroom." It's like, "That's great, son.
Thanks for sharing.
Just go. Yeah, just, you don't have to tell me. Just go.
Yep. Have fun." Okay, so there's another little topic, Bradley, I just want to throw in there before we move on to talking about the change agent in particular, which is the idea of critical mass, which is that point in the adoption process where things start to kind of snowball and take on a life of their own. And one of the useful kind of bullet points that's in this chapter is there's four strategies for getting to that critical mass. And I thought we might have a quick chat about what those four are.
Yeah.
Okay. So number one, I'm just going to read a quote from the book because I think it's highly relevant to what happens in schools. And the author says, "Highly respected individuals in a system's hierarchy for initial adoption of the innovation should be targeted. For example, when the president of an organization champions a technology such as email and is the first to utilize the new technology to send messages to other individuals in the organization, an obvious meta-communication message is implied that other individuals should adopt the new technology to respond to the president's electronic messages. And I think that's exactly what we were saying in the past couple of chapters that we've looked at, Bradley, is that if you can get people in the school senior management team, and indeed the head teacher, to be seen, not just to be, but to be seen to be at the forefront of adopting, enthusiastically adopting these new technologies, then that is incredibly influential to other people in the system.
Yeah, it's trying to think of an example. I mean, really, that's the best one I got. I mean, it's like if you're trying to implement new things, you know, it's got to start from the top. And if the top, it's like when you're, here's a good example. It's like when you're putting in a new policy for purchasing. If the person in charge doesn't follow the policies, then nobody else, why does anybody else do it? I mean, if people at the top have to be the ones that follow the rules to the letter, because otherwise it's like people would just say, well, they don't do it, I don't have to do it either. And it's like the whole do as I do, you know, do as I say, not as I do kind of conundrum.
Yeah, it's as if compliance sort of falls off by 10% at every level of management. And if the top level is only doing it 40%, then by the time you get down to the classroom teacher, they'd be doing it 0%, if not negative. So it's very, very influential. And I think more and more, you know, I had a visit from a number of school leaders from Denmark quite recently. And we've had huge visits from Denmark year on year on year since we started iPad programs, and it's been very influential in Denmark. They've taken the ideas back and done great things with them. But the thing that I always like about the Danes when they visit, and the reason I always take their visits no matter how many people they want to bring, is because they always bring school leaders. They never bring classroom teachers. They always bring the school leaders, and they bring 25 head teachers at a time. And there is nothing I do in the entire year that is as influential as that one afternoon that I spend with that group, because I'm talking to 25 head teachers who have the authority, not only just to decide, but also to go and influence entire schools and school districts to do the things that they want to do, that they see us doing as well. And it's great to, if you get those people in the room, that's, you know, your life is a joy, because not only are they, do they tend to be the smartest people in the room as well, but they're also very, very able to influence others. Many, many others, you know, in that one room, the influence that I have on those 25 people might cascade down to who knows how many hundreds or possibly thousands of individual classroom teachers all across that country. It's a super valuable opportunity that I love taking as much as often as I can.
Yeah, it's like you're going to the top and you can let the ideas like, you know, spread through. I mean, instead of having to start at the bottom or the middle, and I give you, probably the worst place is to start at the middle, because then the ideas have to go down and up. But it's like if you've got a school that's like trying to be innovative with technology, and the headmaster is saying that, but yet, you know, you're saying, okay, but yet we still don't do direct deposit for payroll. We don't allow our families to pay their tuition online. It's like it has to be everybody. Like it's got to be something from the top. Like we're going to innovate here. We're going to go digital. And it's hard to do that if, like, you have subsets of the operation that just aren't.
Yeah. I mean, I remember when we first started doing email at school. Now, not long after I started, you're talking about 06, 07. When we started doing email, the thing that got everybody onto email was the head teacher decided, she said, right, no more green sheets, they were called. It was like the announcements for the day were all printed out on green paper. She said, that's all done. Everything's coming out by email as of the first day of term. And that was it. And once that happened, once that kind of went out, and more importantly, once she started sending them out by email and not sending them on paper, because she actually followed through on what she was saying, that was what got the whole ship turned around onto email within about a fortnight. And that was a very powerful step to take as well.
Yes, so before we move on, let's thank our last sponsor of the night. Fine folks at Shobee. It's an iPad app for paperless classrooms. With Shobee, teachers can easily assign, collect, and review student work on their iPads and then provide rich feedback on the documents using features such as the pen tool, text, and voice notes. Students can show their learning creatively by submitting to Shobee from thousands of iPad apps or by using Shobee's built-in tools. New to Shobee this year is a gradebook feature for Shobee Pro, which allows teachers to easily add, review, and export student grades. More great features like portfolios and parent access are coming to Shobi this fall. Shobi Basic is free for teachers to use, and they can use it with their entire classroom. But if you subscribe to Shobi Pro for a year, you get 30% off the retail price. So go to Shobi.com or go to the App Store and search for Shobi, S-H-O-W-B-I-E. That's Shobi and Shobi.com. Thanks to Shobi for sponsoring the show.
Okay. Bradley, there's a couple of things I just want to wrap up on with that list of ways to get to critical mass. There's a couple of other ones I just want to throw in. They're a lot shorter than the discussion we just had. But the second one is that you can shape individuals' perception by implying that adoption is inevitable or very desirable, or indeed that the critical mass has already happened, whether or not it actually has. But you can kind of give that impression. And I think a friend of mine is a psychologist, and he said that one of the best ways to kind of embed change is to, remember the phrase he used, but he said you have to normalize the idea of the innovation even before it has become normalized. So you sort of talk as if it's already a thing. You know, you'll hear me do this quite a lot. You know, you'll hear me talk about things like the fact that Windows is a legacy technology, right? It's clearly not. I mean, it's being actively developed, and Word is a legacy document format. It's clearly not. It's a live document format. But I kind of use those phrases partly just to tweak people a little bit, but also to try and move people's minds into a mindset where Windows in Office is not the number one dominant platform that everybody thinks it still is, even though it's clearly not that anymore. Trying to just imply that adoption or the change is inevitable is very influential in people's minds too.
Yeah, it's like if you say it enough, people start to believe it.
Yeah.
And if you consistently walk around and like talking about, we're not like trying to, bag on Windows, but like you're just trying to, you don't want to sow seeds of like all these other platforms when you're trying to focus on this one and getting the most out of this one.
Yeah. And I find sometimes that you go to education events where you got a room full of people who are interested in educational technology, but they kind of want some leadership on the whole topic. And too often I've sat in the crowd and I've listened to people who say, well, it's a bit of a mixed economy. We'll have a bit of this and a bit of that, and you've got to have a balance. And, I don't have a lot of time for that kind of attitude, because what I find is that people everywhere are just dying for some leadership on educational technology, and they're not getting it anywhere. If this podcast can help, then it helps, and great. But, I can't reach that many people. But, my plea to people who are speaking at educational technology conferences is have an opinion. Come and say, here is one thing that we did and it's great, or here's another thing that we did and it's great, or this is the thing we did and it wasn't great. But, be a lot more definite in what you say than just a bit of this, bit of that, bit of column A, bit of column B. Leadership, I think, is key all the way through. Two more things, Bradley, on critical mass, just really quickly. Another way to do it is you can introduce the innovation to whole groups where the members of that group may be relatively more innovative. So, for example, giving it to one department first. This is more of a kind of business organization thing than a school thing, because the problem in schools is, you see schools do this all the time. They say, right, we're buying iPads for the science department. But the problem is in secondary schools, the students who go to the science department are also going to all the other departments as well. It's very difficult to get a whole classroom scenario going on a department basis. What you could do is you could give them to the teachers in one department, because that's at least a kind of properly identified group, whereas giving it to the students in science is much more complicated, I think. So it's possible to kind of fall down on that one as well, I think. And the last one is just to provide incentives for early adoption. I struggle to kind of think of an example of what that may be in schools, but I don't know if you're the first department to get them, do you get free ones for your teachers or something? I don't know. Maybe you just get more of the budget.
That's always the
buy all the apps in the budget first before any other department gets in there.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about the change agent, and then we'll the last sort of 15 minutes, Bradley, and we'll wrap up.
Sounds good.
You said you'd heard the phrase change agent before.
Oh, a jillion times.
Many times.
Yeah, especially at my last job. Like, you can tell the guy that was in charge had read this book, because he talked about, like, needing people in his organizations to be change agents and drive it forward.
And the thing is, you know, I think a lot of us think that change agent is just sort of douchebag speak for somebody who does something, you know. But in fact, the change agent has the role of a change agent has a very definite meaning in the world of Everett Rogers' book. And what a change agent does is they're the person who they stage interventions, if you like, and an intervention is a focused action that is designed to bring about a behavior change in the client. Now, the phrase client kind of comes from the group that the innovators are trying to reach. And Rogers' book is kind of couched in the time of the Agricultural Extension Service in the US, where these groups of farm researchers were trying to reach farmers. And that was their client group. But in the book, there are many examples of other people, other groups and other people working with those groups to change behaviors in some way, whether to adopt medical treatments or different kinds of methods of food preparation or growing crops or whatever it is. So for us in education, you know, we might be the change agents, and the clients, generally speaking, are the teachers in the school, but also the students, also the parents. And sometimes, indeed, your IT staff as well. So one of the things to be aware of is that you might be actually fighting a change agent job on two or three fronts at once, possibly even four or more, if you have to deal with local authority as well. So you might have to present multiple faces to different groups as you navigate your way through this problem.
Yeah, you know, when I think of, like, change agents in our school, I often don't think of me there. Like, I think of the teachers who are really, really passionate about this are the ones that actually change things and drive it forward.
Yeah, and in some ways, those are, like, if you think about it this way, you're the change agency, and you need to recruit them to be your agents. You know, you're sort of one level above that, where you're trying to get your innovation adopted. You need these people in the middle, and then they probably need other people below to get to the real clientele at the lower layers of this whole structure, if you like. There's a great line in the book, Bradley, I just wanted to read out, where Rogers says that he said, change agents would not be needed if there were no social and technical chasms between the change agency and the client. So when you, for example, let's go back to the farming example, you have a bunch of biologists and botanists soil scientists working in a university situation, and then you've got farmers out in the field. And there is a massive gulf between those two people in terms of their formal education, certainly their life experience, possibly their socioeconomic class as well. And the change agent and then the change agent's assistants have to somehow do a job of bridging that extremely academic and abstract, possibly, world with the very down-to-earth farming world. And that's a great example of that job. And the same can be true of in schools, where you've got to go from, perhaps a very kind of theoretical curriculum, for example, to how do you actually work that out in practice in the classroom. And, you know, in Scotland, we've been through this change over the past sort of 10 years in this thing called Curriculum for Excellence. And it has some excellent educational ideas behind it. But where it has struggled a little bit is in the translation of those ideas into actual practical action in the classroom. And I think if there's one thing that maybe could have been done better in Curriculum for Excellence, it is recruiting change agents and aides to actually, you know, correctly take those steps out from the theory behind it to the actual action that happens in the classroom. And that's where the role of the change agent comes in. You can see how kind of vital it can be just because of that. And those are some of the chasms, you know, because the organization or the people who are trying to innovate, they've got great technical competence. They have high socioeconomic status. They're professors. They're distinguished academics. They're, you know, sir this and lord that and whatever. And then you've got all the way down to, you know, teachers in the classroom. And the fact that you can't bridge that gap immediately means you have to recruit people in the middle to sort of step it down all the way to people who are trying to do the job day to day. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I lost my train of thought.
That's okay. One of the things that you see quite often happens, though, in schools is that teachers will be what we call in this country, at least, I don't know if you have a different word for it, but we talk about being seconded out of your school into some government organization to do a bit of work and then to take that idea back to your school and other schools. So people might get taken out of their job in a school for maybe a year or 2 years to develop something about, teaching Chinese or the feasibility of bringing in Italian or something like that. And then once that job is done, those people will go back to their schools and other schools. At which point, that's quite an interesting change agent role because when the teachers come out of the school, they're very authentic and they've been teachers and they've got a lot of real world experience. But as the work goes on, their experience ages and diverges from the experience that's happening in the classroom right then and there. And when the teacher comes back to their school, they're no longer necessarily seen quite as authentic as they were when they left because they've kind of taken on some of the aspects of the change agency, if you like, the government agency that took them away and made them become the change agent for whatever it is they want to do. And this is, if I dive forward in the notes a little bit, this is one of the things that is a great risk for people who are recruited as change agents or assistants to change agents is that they tend to kind of get drawn upwards in the process, that they tend to take on the language, they tend to acquire, they accrete all the acronyms that change organizations use, and that they start to drift away from the people that used to be peers to them. And now they're sort of talking in three-letter acronyms and they're talking about committees that nobody knows about and they're talking about reports that nobody else has read and so on. And they can lose their authenticity, and that's a big risk, one that has to be managed very carefully as that process goes on.
Well, and one of the things that like comes to mind to me when I think about change agent, and this is something we've talked about a lot, is the role of being able to communicate persuasively mm-hmm. and clearly. Because, I mean, you think about some of the smartest people but have no people skills and they cannot get anybody to do anything for them. And then you have people in your organizations that can get anything done and people will do anything for them. Mm-hmm. And like, what's the difference? And to me, it all comes down to like how these people, how these people communicate and how these people treat people. Mm-hmm. And like, you'll have those people that like lead by, you have people lead by position and then people that lead by leadership.
Yeah. It's all about empathy, isn't it, really? It's about how much the person who's trying to drive change can put themselves in the place of people who might have to actually execute that change or that transformation. And one example from my own recent years, I wrote a whole new technologies curriculum for the school from start to finish. So I wrote a lot of units that I would never myself teach, and other colleagues at lower down the school would teach those units. And one of the things I said to them at the start was, I said, listen, look, I am very aware that you, as primary teachers, have got 8 different curriculum areas. You've got to show great commitment to all of them, right? So I want to start by saying that I am very clearly limiting how much I expect you to do in this one area. And at that, they're all just like, oh, thank you. Because, quite often they get people coming in and they say, well, obviously, social studies is the most important part of the curriculum. Therefore, you're going to spend 80% of your time on this. And then the people in maths come in and say the same thing. And the people in English come in and say the same thing. And this classic sort of secondary school situation is that everybody's subject is the most important subject in the whole world. And the rest of them are a stupid waste of time. And I think that was one case where I was able to exercise some empathy and say, look, I appreciate you guys are busy. I don't want to put too much burden on you, but here are the things that we're going to be expected to hit over the course of, the 3-year period that you're covering or whatever.
You think, knowing that like most of Apple's trainers for education mm-hmm. are former teachers, is that correct?
They are supposed to be either teachers or relatively recently teachers. Yeah.
So I wonder if, like, not that they did it for this reason, but there's an aspect of reading this that makes me think, like, this is one of the reasons. For someone to come in there and to talk about how to do this stuff is much more effective when you can, like, you can go to that empathy skill. Like, I've done this. They can make references to things I've done in the classroom, like how I did it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think the teacher world as a whole is very resistant to hearing from people who are not teachers. You know, I think it's almost a prerequisite to have credibility with teachers that you yourself have to be a teacher, you know. And I think it's kind of surprising that Sir Ken Robinson is the one person who seems to get a pass on that, because he hasn't necessarily done a whole lot of classroom teaching himself, as far as I know. But teachers seem to sort of flock to his ideas. I don't know if he has a great sense of humor. I don't know if it's just that brings people along. But for the most part, if you want to get up in front of teachers and talk about how to you know, teach them technology or whatever, you've got to carry a lot of credibility into that room. And I know, for example, that Apple in education, they hire people who were teachers to go and be, you know, business development managers and so on for Apple. And a lot of the people who work in Apple education do have an education background, which is something that's quite interesting and that's not always true in all businesses. And even in other companies who do education, you've got people. I mean, I was at an education event just a couple of days ago where it was about university admissions. And the guy who was doing the whole show, he was talking to us at the table and he said, you know, 2 years ago, I was working for an architectural firm. And I was like, okay, so now you're in education, right? But companies who know about this credibility problem often take steps to try and recruit people from education, or indeed the other sectors they're trying to hit in vertical markets, and bring those people in so they have that credibility with the client group they're trying to hit.
Yeah, that credibility there, that's your word.
It you gotta have it. Is. Yep. Yep.
I mean, you gotta have that, like, you know, externally, you gotta have that internally. Gotta have, that's the big word.
And the problem is, Bradley, that credibility ages out over time as well. You know, and I've met people who, you know, they work in educational technology, but they're talking about when they were a teacher in, 2001, you know, or, you know, people you meet who have got teaching experience from 25 years ago, and they haven't actually been in a classroom for 25 years. And you start to realize through conversations sometimes that, you know, your experience actually isn't very relevant anymore, particularly when we're talking about going into a world of mobile devices and Wi-Fi and homeschool working and different things like that, that these people have just never had that experience. And it's a tricky one to balance, because obviously they've got a lot of experience in being a trainer, being a change agent, but their credibility is starting to age a little bit. And that's something that you have to be aware of as well. Probably not so much a problem for, you know, doing something in your school, but if you're doing a long-term project with people coming out of school, how long can you keep them out of school before their credibility starts to wane? It's quite a tricky balancing act.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you go back to like Apple's trainers, like, you know, how long can they do that with saying, like, you know, again, 15 years ago when I was in the classroom, you know, it's like almost need to like have cycles, you know, people need to like take sabbaticals and go teach for a little bit, or, mm-hmm. you know, I kind of like my new role where I'm teaching a handful of classes a week and gives me like that feel for how things are going, but I can still kind of back out and do other work as well that affects the whole school.
Yeah. Yep. So just to kind of wrap this up, Bradley, Rogers lists out 7 tasks of a change agent. And I think this is quite an interesting checklist just to kind of use to finish off the show. There's 7 things that a change agent has to do, and they sort of go from beginning to end. And the change agent is, again, he's asking you to look at the innovation decision process from the outside in rather than from the inside out. And the first step a change agent has to do is to create a need for change on the part of the client. Now, whether that is just about telling them about the innovation or promoting it to them in some way, or even indeed advertising, that depends on the situation, depends on the innovation. I suppose depends on the obvious relative advantage or lack of relative advantage that the innovation has. But in general, the change agent's job is to somehow create that awareness of their need on the part of the client.
Well, and it's like you don't know what you don't have until you don't, you know, exist.
Yeah. So even just telling somebody about it creates that little bit of uncertainty in their mind that they will then take some steps to try and resolve.
Envy at its core.
Yeah. And the next thing is to establish an information exchange relationship. And I think this is critical. And this is a hard job when you're working in a very big school, that you have to have some mechanism by which if somebody does, if you've successfully created that uncertainty in somebody's mind about adopting an innovation, how can you be in a position to provide them with the knowledge that they need to move forward in their innovation decision process. Plenty of different ways you can do that. I've seen, you know, focus groups happen. I've spoken at staff information days, proposal days, exploratory days, things like that. But also just, you know, departmental level. I did one thing with a school where they brought me in for the day and I didn't talk to the whole staff at all until the end of the day. But what I had done beforehand is I'd spent half hours going around different subject departments and talking to them about an iPad program, how that would impact science and art and English and social studies and different things. And that was quite an effective way to do that, was to bring somebody in, a change agent, if you like, but then put me in a position where I was able to give information to all these different groups on a small basis rather than just giving one bland message to everybody. And that was quite an effective day we spent together there. Next things, and the change agent has to diagnose problems. And in two respects. One, why does the existing solution not work? And what other information needs does the client have as they explore the innovation? So how do I get my iPad turned on? How do I get access to my old documents? The kind of things that you need to know to get started with an innovation. The change agent has to be there to diagnose any problems that they have and give them solutions as best they can. It's very, very important.
Yeah, and this is also like I feel like with technology, recreating of workflows. Mm-hmm. Where it's like this is how you used to do it. You know, we say problem. It's like the existing way doesn't work. So this is how you used to do it, and this is how we can do it now. This is like not school related, but I've had this, you know, the conversation with having to show people how to use Apple Music. And it's like I used to do it this way, so how do I do that now? Mm-hmm. And so you're diagnosing the problem of them not knowing how to do it, sort of thing.
Yeah, you often get people who come to you and they're unable to really articulate their problem. So you've got to listen, you've got to say, well, that sounds like you're trying to make a playlist. You know, I just want my music back. You know, what do you mean by that? Well, I mean, I had my playlist before. Okay, how do we set up playlists in this new streaming world or whatever? So yeah, that's exactly the kind of thing I'm thinking about there, Bradley. Two other things that come along. One is creating an intent to change on the part of the client. And secondly, translating those intentions into action. So one way that I've seen this happen quite effectively is where people come alongside teachers and they help them. They take a lesson plan, for example, and they work them through how to turn that lesson plan into the same lesson, but with the kind of underlying assumption that technology is available. So how do you go from your traditional paper-based lesson to a lesson where you might not be necessarily teaching technology now, you're still teaching, I don't know, volcanoes or whatever, but you're teaching it with the computer in hand, and what can you put in there to help along the way in that respect? Finally, two things you got to do. You got to get on the horse, you got to ride the horse, and you got to get off the horse, right? So this is about getting off the horse. Is number one, once adoption's happened, the change agent has got to stabilize that adoption and prevent discontinuance. You remember we talked about discontinuation before as people adopting and then not using it. And that's something that is disturbingly prevalent, I think, in schools is we've got all these computers, got all these iPads, but we don't really use them anymore. Why not? And the reason being because whoever the change agent was in that situation didn't normalize the technology and give enough confirmatory messages such that the people who had made the adoption decision found additional reinforcement for their decision. So if you go back to the innovation decision process, there is a step beyond adoption, which is confirmation. And the job of the change agent is to come in at that point and say, yeah, you're doing it right. You've got great results. Let's share those results. Let's make sure that people know about what's happened. And let's hear from other people that, yeah, they've had seen similar things, that you're not just one person out alone doing your iPad thing and nobody else is there to help you or to agree with you.
And you know, one of the things, it's like worse than not adoption. I think that like not adopting something is almost better than like adopting it and stopping it, because from a going back to the beginning of the show, we were talking about like how ideas spread and how influence peer networks and word of mouth and how that can influence it. Like if you've rolled out like a technology program to a department as a pilot, Mm-hmm. And then like people are just frustrated. And it's not like, we gave it up. It didn't work right. So we gave it up. Yeah. Well, that's going to spread like negative seeds to other departments.
Mm-hmm. And that also, that sort of salts the earth for the next one as well. So like, we had a pilot a couple of years ago. It didn't really work. Here's another pilot. Yeah, that's probably not going to work either. So you end up in a kind of negative and downward spiral, I think, is one of the risks there. But also, for the kids in that class, they have adopted, right? And then they just get it taken away from them. You know, it's a bad experience all around, I think. But the last stage, the last thing a change agent has to do, Bradley, is they've got to form what is described as a terminal relationship. That there's got to be a point where you have to stop hand-holding people along this, you know, making an iPad lesson plan process, and they have to start just doing it for themselves. And that is when your deployment becomes completely self-sustaining. It's when it's part of the culture of the school, it's part of the practice of the school, and it's not just one person killing themselves to get around all these teachers and help them make lesson plans. It's the teachers themselves are thinking up new ways, and that's when you get to that point. You're into a new world, if you like, and the adoption is very unlikely to go backwards at that point.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like, you know, there's some things I'm learning as a parent. When your kids, like, you have to help them get dressed, and then, like, all of a sudden they can just, like, get dressed on their own.
Yeah.
And so, like, you know, there's things like, we'll tie your shoes on your own. Like, those are the things, like, you teach, and at some point you got to just, like, let go, yeah. And you've got to be able to do it on your own. And so you can't like handhold, you're trying to, help, okay, I'll help you make this lesson. Let's do this. Give you some ideas. And at some point, like you've got to be able to step back and that has to continue. Cause if it doesn't continue without you being there, mm-hmm. like, you really have not done your job. Like you're just kind of doing it for them. I'm reminded, like I was in my high school drafting class and teacher was great, but like we pretty much all figured out that if we just asked him for help enough, he would eventually just do it for us because he would like help you yep. do it. And then like, you know, over a 2-week project, if he helped you once a day, well, your project was done by the end of it.
Yep.
And well, that's what you don't want. Like for a teacher to like, hey, I don't remember how to do this. Can you help me? And then you help them. And then it's like, they ask you enough. And all of a sudden it's like, you've gone through 2 years with them. And it's like, if I quit and never helped you again, like you wouldn't do anything.
Yep. Yep. And it's something that I am sort of concerned about in the long term is that one-to-one deployments seem quite fragile. And I've seen it more than once where if the sort of driving mind behind the deployment leaves the organization, I've seen, university scale deployments just fall apart in the course of a year because the people behind it just left. And that's something that I remain kind of concerned about. And I'm not sure exactly what the way is past that. But, maybe it's something to do with professional standards. Maybe it's something to do with, government requirements, perhaps even, I've certainly been advocating for things like, in Scotland, we have this, we talk about young people are entitled to a balanced curriculum that addresses their needs and so on. There's a lot of language and it uses the language of entitlements. And I've often suggested to people, why don't we put in there, every young person is entitled to access to the internet and access to a computer for their own use. And the answer, of course, is that whoever writes that line has to then pay for the deployment, which is more difficult. But the point being that if you can frame it in the right language, such as the language of young people are entitled to, you could possibly move a long way down the road from just, it would be nice if we could enhance learning with computers or something like that,
Well, I don't even think it's just technology, like deployments that are fragile in schools. I think so many things your school, that's the downside of like a strong head of school or head teacher mm-hmm. is when like so many of the great ideas are pushed down through them. When they leave, if you've not built up that culture through those, like and people have bought in through why they work.
Yep.
Then when they leave, like those ideas can easily just like fade away over time. It's not, mm-hmm. it's not immediate, but like I'll give you a good example. So like the church we go to, the pastor is going to a different church. He's moving to Nashville. He's been there 7.5 years. And so much of the things he's done, like he's ingrained into the culture. Mm-hmm. I don't think they're going to go away anytime soon. And so much so, like, I think the next pastor that's called to the church we'll have to kind of, you know, the way the church believes now and the church's core identity, I think it'll have to be, like, we'll find someone that feels that way because we have such a strong identity. Mm-hmm. And if we didn't have a strong identity as a church, then the next pastor could almost implement it. What you'd almost just pick somebody and then they're going to implement what they want to implement.
Yeah.
And so like, if you've got a, you know, an innovation of technology or a environment or a culture of technology innovation in your school, and it's ingrained throughout the school, teachers and students and parents, the next headmaster, if they don't support that, they're going to be laughed out of the building.
Yeah. Yeah. And I really feel that, you know, for example, with us at Cedars, you know, being a one-to-one school is becoming part of our identity now. I think we're almost there. I wouldn't say we're quite there yet, but, you know, by the end of our next deployment, that will be 9 years as a one-to-one school. And I think once you get into double figures, you're starting to think, well, you're almost into a world where the entire school has had that experience together. You know, because at the moment we're still in that situation where the upper end of the school remember the school before that idea. Whereas in a few more years' time, we will have a situation where everybody who's been through the school or who's in the school at the moment will have been through, experienced the school as a one-to-one iPad school up to that point. So I think it's it takes a little bit of time. But like you said, Bradley, you know, a school turns over very quickly. You know, you got a whole new set of pupils every 13 years, a completely new set. And ideas can come and go quite quickly in that time frame. So, yeah. You want to bring it home with a couple of take-home ideas for people?
Yes.
Number one, just be aware of the change agent role and be aware that you might be that person. Right? You know how they say, if you can't identify who the sucker is in this deal, it's probably you. Well, it's kind of the same thing with change agent. If you don't know who the change agent is, it's probably going to have to be you. But also to be aware that even if you're not necessarily the change agent to your teachers, you might be the face of the deployment to parents, for example. And that's a situation that I find myself in sometimes, where I'm the technology guy to parents, even though, you know, my colleagues will take leading roles in trying to advance technology and to other teachers in various areas such as, you know, PE or maths or whatever. Next thing, can you recruit aides? You know, so an aide is somebody who is halfway between the change agent and the client, in the sense that they're not as qualified and maybe not as educated, not as technically competent as the change agent themselves, but they're more authentic and more acceptable to the client. So can you actually work at that multiple level? And that may be a good thing in a much bigger school, where you may have to, if you're senior management, you may have to draft in, you know, heads of department or senior teachers to try and kind of be your eyes and ears, if you like, and your voice around about the school, because you just don't scale up to that kind of number yourself.
Just one person.
You're just one person. Yeah, that's it. Look for your early adopters, you know, back to our innovativeness and adopter categories topic. Look for those early adopters. Try and remember they're the respected ones in the group who lead opinion. If you can hit them and get them on your side, you're a long, long way to just bringing the rest of them on is almost an inevitability over time. And finally, just I would say, Bradley, just be aware that there is a gap between you and the masses out there in terms of your, you know, technical competence, education, status, whatever it is. You're not like them. And it's something to bear in mind, particularly for teachers who are very technically inclined and have been for a long time. It's hard to remember that. I certainly find it hard to remember that you can be a good and competent teacher and not be really into technology. We can argue whether that actually does qualify as being a competent teacher in the 21st century, but that's another debate for another time. However, the point being that there is a gap in knowledge and expertise and experience, and being aware of that gap is the first step to bridging the gap. And I think that's kind of the message I would leave with people, if there's nothing else to take away from the show.
Well, I would add and have extreme patience with people.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to go a long way by being patient with people, I think.
Yep, and just providing that information as their doubts and confusions come up, just being there with the answer is very, very reassuring to them.
Yes, yes. Yeah, okay. It's interesting stuff. Like, you know, it's these are principles that are work in business, they work in schools, and like they're kind of universally applied.
We could do a whole side series in this, Bradley, on how to apply this entire topic to churches, eh?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It'll be like the in-app purchase edition. I think, you know, chapter 8 and 9, I think they're not like as, I'm trying to think of the word, they're fundamental to understanding this and understanding like where your role is in an organization. Mm-hmm. And like, as you said, if you don't know the change agent, you're probably it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So I think, Bradley, next time we'll take a look at chapter 10, which is the innovation in organizations chapter, and try and draw out some of the ideas that might be useful for schools in there. And then the last chapter to finish the series is about consequences of innovations and whether they're deliberate or accidental and intended and unintended and so on, because as we know, everything always comes with some unintended consequences.
You misspell organizations in the notes. You have an S with it. It's got a Z.
Well, that's the in-app purchase, Bradley, if you want that as well.
You want the American spelling. USA. USA.
USA. USA. Okay. Shall we leave it there for today?
I think so. So everybody wish me luck on baby number 3. And hopefully by the show that's aired, we have a healthy baby girl.
Not your first rodeo.
But my last.
But your last. Yeah, that's a whole other topic as well.
Yes.
Okay. So if people want to find us online, Bradley, I am Fraser Spears on the web. No, I am Fraser Spears on Twitter and Spears.org on the web. That's it.
I am Bradley Chambers on Twitter and chambersdaily.com on the web. And you can find this show at outofschool.net. And if you want to leave us a review in iTunes, you can go to itunes.com/outofschool to do that. We would certainly appreciate that. Thanks, everybody, for listening this week. Again, if you have colleagues that you think might like the show, we'd appreciate you sharing it with them. Word of mouth, as we said, is a great way. You can either put up out-of-school billboards in your city, or you can just tell your friends about it as well. Either one is fine with us.
If you're a highly respected early adopter, do be our change agent and tell people about the show.
And hire an aide.
Hire an aide, yes.
But don't be an innovator. No, but if they're just finding the show now, are they a laggard or a late majority?
I'm going to go early majority, or numbers are not that big.
That's true. Good point.
There's billions of people who have never listened to the show. What an opportunity.
Yes, yes. It's up to you. Only you can prevent people from not listening to our show and forest fires.
All right.
So, Bradley. Thanks for having a good week, everybody.
Okay. Cheers.